He found that much had changed in Matabele land since old Tom Harkness had drawn his map. And Zuger noted these changes and drew his conclusions from them. As a further exercise to pass the waiting days, he began drawing up a battle plan for a campaign against the old king Mzilikazi. The requirements in men and weapons, the logistics of supply and resupply, the lines of march, and the most expedient methods of bringing the impis to battle. For Zuger was a soldier with a dream which might one day become reality only through military action. Unsuspecting, Gandang was flattered by Zuga's interest, and he answered every question with pride in his nation's might and its achievements. Despite this work Zuga had given himself, the days dragged past. "The king will not give you audience until after the festival," Gandang repeated. But he was wrong. The evening before the festival began, two elderly Ndunas, blue heron feathers nodding above the silvery woolen caps of close-cropped hair, entered the camp in the acacia grove, and Gandang greeted them with deep respect, listened to them attentively, and then came to Zuga. "They have come to take you to the king," he said simply. There were three small fires burning before the king's hut, and over the middle one crouched a wizened ape-like figure, who crooned a low incantation through toothless gums, rocking on his haunches and occasionally adding a pinch of powder or a sprig of herb into one of the large earthenware pots that bubbled over the flames. The witch doctor was festooned with the grisly accoutrements of his profession, the dried skins of reptiles, the claws of eagle and leopard, the inflated bladder of a lion, the skull of ape and the teeth of crocodile, small stoppered girds of potions and powders, the horn of dika to be used as a blooding cup, and other unidentifiable charms and elixirs. He was the orchestrator of the entire festival, the most important event in the Matabele calendar. The gathering of the first fruits of the harvest, the blessing of the nation's herds, and the setting of the warlike campaigns which would occupy the Amadoda during the coming dry season. Thus the assembled Ndunas watched his preparations with attention and awe. There were 30 or so men in the squatting circle of elders, the senior Ndunas of the nation, the king's privy council. The small courtyard was crowded. The tall, thatched, sloping side of the king's hut towered 30 feet or so above them all, the top of it lost in darkness. The thatching was skillfully done, with intricate patterns worked into the grass, and before the low doorway stood an armchair of European design and construction. With a small prick of recognition, Zuga realized that this must be the same chair given to the king by his own grandfather Moffat, Chedi, nearly 20 years before. "Bayeti, Mzilikazi, the bull elephant of the Matabele!" Gandang had coached Zuga in the correct etiquette, the formal greetings and the behaviour which the king would expect. As Zuga crossed the narrow yard of bare earth, he intoned the king's praise names, not shouting them aloud, not crawling on his knees as a subject would have done, for he was an Englishman and an officer of the queen. Nevertheless, at a distance of 10 feet from the king's chair, Zuga squatted down, his own head below the level of the king's, and waited. The figure in the chair was much smaller than he had expected for a warrior of such fearsome reputation, and as his eyes adjusted to the gloom, Zuga saw that the king's feet and hands were small and delicately shaped, almost feminine, but that his knees were grotesquely swollen and distorted by the gout and arthritis that was attacking them. The king was an old man now, nobody knew how old, but he had been a fighting warrior at the turn of the century. His once fine muscles had sagged so that his belly bulged out onto his lap, the skin stretched and riven with stria like that of a pregnant woman. His head seemed too big for the narrow shoulders, and the neck hardly strong enough to support it. But the eyes which watched Zuga intently from the seams of wrinkles and loose bagged skin were black and bright and lively. "How is my old friend Chedi?" the king asked in a piping, high-pitched voice. Zuger had last seen his maternal grandfather 20 years previously. The only memory that persisted was of a long, flowing white beard. "He is well and happy," Zuger replied. "He sends you his greeting and respect." The old man in the armchair nodded the big, ungainly head contentedly. "You may present your gifts," he said. And there was a buzz of comment from the Indunas. And even the witch doctor at the fire looked up as the ivory tusk was carried in by 3 of Gundang's warriors, staggering under its weight, and laid before the king's chair. The witch doctor clearly resented this interruption of the ritual cleansing and the diversion of interest and attention from himself, and now with 2 of his assistants to help him, he made an officious show of carrying one of the steaming pots from the fire and placing it between the king's feet. Then he and his assistants raised a large kaross of stitched leopard skins and spread it like a tent over the king and his chair, so that the steam from the pot was trapped beneath it. Within a minute, there was a paroxysm of gasps and coughing from under the fur blanket, and when at last the witch doctor removed it, the king was streaming sweat and choking for breath, his eyes inflamed and pouring tears. But any demons had been expelled by the coughing, and impurities washed away by the sweat and tears. The gathering waited in respectful silence, while the king recovered his breath, and the witch doctor withdrew to prepare the next potion. With his breath still wheezing and whistling in his throat, Mzilikatsi reached into the small chest beside his chair and brought out the sealed package which Zuger had sent him. "Speak the words," the king handed it to Zuger, demanding that he read the letter. Although he was illiterate, the king understood clearly the uses of the written word. For 20 years he had corresponded with Zuger's grandfather, who always sent one of his mission students to deliver his letters, to read them to the king, and to record the king's reply. Zuger stood erect and opened the package. He read aloud, translating from the English as he went along, and adding a few small embellishments to the original text. When he had finished, there was a respectful silence from the tribal elders, and even the king studied the tall and magnificently attired figure before him with new attention. The firelight danced on the burnished brass buttons and badges of Zuger's dress uniform. The scarlet cloth of his coat seemed to glow like the very flames of the fire. The witch doctor would have intervened again, coming forward with a brew of steaming medicine for the king to swallow, but Mzilikatsi waved him away irritably. Knowing that this was the moment when the king's interest was at its zenith, Zuger asked smoothly, "Does the king see these signs of my queen? They are her special marks, and every ruler should have such a mark to prove his power and the rock-like nature of his words." Zuger turned and beckoned the bearer, who knelt in the gateway behind him, and the terrified man crawled to Zuger's feet, not daring to look up at the king, and handed to Zuger the small tea caddy that contained the carved ivory seal and the sticks of wax. "I have prepared one of these for the king, that his dignity and power may be known to all men." Mzilikatsi was unable to contain his interest. He craned forward in his chair and called Zuger closer. Kneeling before him, Zuger prepared the wax, melting it onto the lid of the tea caddy with a taper lit from the fire. Then he made the impression of the seal upon it, and when it had hardened, handed it to the king. "It is an elephant," the king recognized the beast with unconcealed amazement. "The great black bull elephant of the Matabele," Zuger agreed. "Speak the words." The king touched the lettering on the border and commanded Zuger to translate it. "Mzilikatsi, Nkosi Nkulu." The king clapped his hands with delight and passed the seal to his senior Induna. Soon they were all clucking and exclaiming over the imprint, the wax impression passing from hand to hand. "Bakela," the king told Zuger, "you must come to me again on the day following the Chawala ceremony. You and I have much to discuss." Then, with a wave of his hand, he dismissed the splendid young man from his presence, and patiently, resignedly, gave himself up to the ministrations of the hovering doctor. The full moon rose well past midnight, and the fires were stacked with new logs to welcome it, and the singing and drumming began. No man nor woman had dared to pick a single grain of corn from the harvest before this moment, for the rise of the moon heralded the Chawala, the dance of the first fruits, and the entire nation gave itself up to rejoicing. The ceremony began in the middle of the first morning, the massed regiments assembled before their king, filing in column to the vast arena of the cattle stockade, and the earth shook to the crash of bare feet lifted in unison, 25,000 at a time, lifted to the level of the shoulder, and then brought down with the full force of the muscular, hardened bodies of highly trained warriors. Bayeti! They greeted the king with the royal salute. Bayeti! The crash of the feet once more. Bayeti! A third time, and then the dancing began. One regiment at a time coming forward in swaying, singing ranks to perform before Mzilikazi's armchair throne. The perfect timing and execution of the intricate steps made it seem as though they were a single living organism, the shields interlocking and revolving and twisting together like the scales of some gigantic reptile, the dust rising and swirling through their ranks like smoke so that they appeared as wraiths, and their cloaks of fur and their kilts of civet's tails and monkey skins of the pelts of foxes and cats swirled about their legs so they appeared to be divorced from earth, suspended above it on the moving cloud of dust and the soft waves of fur. From the ranks sprang the great champions and the heroes of each regiment, to gear in their pride, leaping as high as their own heads and stabbing furiously at the air, screaming challenge and triumph. The sweat greased their muscles and flew in explosive droplets in the sunlight. Mzilikazi was caught up in the building sea of excitement, and he quaffed from the beer pots that the maidens brought him until his eyes rolled in his head and he could not contain himself further. He struggled from his chair and hobbled out on his swollen and deformed legs, and the champions fell back to give him place. "My father is the finest dancer in all of Matabili land," said Gandang, squatting beside Zuga. The old king tried to leap, but his feet did not leave the ground. He shuffled back and forth, making little pawing gestures, hacking at the air with his toy war spear. "Thus I struck down Barant, the Griqua, and thus his sons died," the nation roared. "The elephant dances, and the earth shakes." And the slamming of 10,000 feet goaded the king to circle in a painful and pathetic parody of the young champion's wild gyrations. "Thus I spurned the tyrant Chaka, and thus I cut the plumes from the headdresses of his messengers and sent them back to him," squealed Mzilikazi. "Bayeti!" thundered the nation. "He, the father of the world!" Exhausted within minutes, the ancient king sank into the dust, and Gandang and two other of the king's sons leapt to their feet from the half-circle of Indunas and raced to his side. Gently they bore him up and carried him back to his chair. And Lobengula, the king's senior son, held a beer pot for him to drink from. The beer dribbled from his chin and ran down the king's heaving chest. "Let their nation dance," gasped the king, and Gandang returned to Zuga's side and squatted beside him. "After war, my father loves best the dance," he explained. The maidens came, rank upon lovely rank, their naked skin shimmering in the glaring sunlight of noon. The tiny beaded apron that barely covered their little triangular sex was all they wore, and their singing was sweet and clear. Mzilikazi hoisted himself from his chair once more and hobbled out to dance with them, passing along the foremost rank, directing the singing with his ritual war spear pointed to the skies. The king danced until he dropped once more and was again carried back to his chair by his sons. By nightfall, Zugo was exhausted. His sweaty neck was chafed by the high stock of his dress coat, and sweat had soaked through the thick scarlet serge in dark patches. His eyes were bloodshot and inflamed from the dust and the glare. His head ached from the cacophony of drums and the roar of Matabele voices. His tongue felt thick and furry from the draughts of sorghum beer that had been pressed upon him, and his back and legs ached from the unfamiliar squatting attitude he had been forced into all that day. But the king was still dancing, hobbling and prancing and squeaking on those twisted and deformed legs of his.